Hello, you're listening to Wine Blast, the place for people with a healthy thirst and an open mind. I'm Susie, he's Peter, and we are both slightly overexcited because in this episode, we get to talk about fascinating people doing their own thing in glorious style. Plus, we have the green light to dive into some truly outstanding wines. What is not to like?
I'm struggling to see the downside, I have to say. We are talking grower champagne, people. This intriguing trend of the last few decades where small producers in this most famous of French wine regions have forced a radical reappraisal of what champagne can and should be. It's a story of bravery against the odds, grim determination, you know, but also one of passion, I guess, you know, authenticity, hope for the future.
You're going all Hollywood on us again, aren't you? And breathe.
I do that.
Maybe let's get a sneak preview of the kind of thing we'll be hearing along the way.
Some of the productions of the big companies where you taste the wine, which has been blended to be perfect, and as a result, it's so boring that you want to scream. But if you have a grower, I think you'll taste individuality. You taste an expression of a wine. I mean, that's the whole point, is they're fun. They're completely delicious. You put them in your mouth and you want to swallow them.
It's all about the swallowing. Charles Lee of London wine merchant Lee and Sandeman there, telling it like it is as ever. Yeah. We'll also be hearing from legendary champagne grower Francis Aigli and his daughter Clémence of the iconic Champagne Aigli-Aurier. So, lots to be getting on with.
Yeah, we should say that this episode is focused on the broader topic of grower champagne, but it's been facilitated by the sponsorship of Lee and Sandeman, partly, of course, because one of their many specialist fields now is grower champagne. And so we're going to be tasting through a range of really pretty bloody delicious grower champagnes from their range too.
We are, aren't we? They've also got a great lockdown story to tell on the grower champagne front, which is something we'll be coming on to very soon. But before we get ahead of ourselves, we should set the scene, shouldn't we? What do we mean by grower champagne? What are we talking about? Why is it exciting? Why should we bother to spend our precious time on this?
So I'm getting Hollywood, you're getting Gordon Ramsay. Right, I see where we're going. But you're right, you know, a bit of context is indeed in order. And I guess it starts with kind of the nuts and bolts of how the Champagne region works.
Which is not straightforward, is it?
No. Do you want to?
These things rarely are straightforward in France, are they?
No.
But essentially, Champagne produces around 300 million bottles a year to sell. Underpinning this are the region's grape growers, all 16,200 of them, who provide the raw materials for the wines. Mm.
So in a region of, what is it, you know, 34,000 just over hectares, that means the average holding is just over 2 hectares, which isn't big.
No. But there are then 3 main ways these wines can make it to market. One is the grower simply sells his grapes to one of the champagne houses, which are the big brands we all know, Moët & Chandon, Laurent Perrier, Veuve Clicquot, etc. Another is the grower makes his or her wine in a cooperative cellar and then sells it themselves or through the co-op. And these can then become own brands or whatever.
Yeah, but it's the final one that really interests us here, isn't it?
Exactly. So the final route to market is where the grower not only grows their own grapes, but also makes and sells their own wine. Mm. And this is known officially in the region as being a récoltant manipulant, or RM. And you'll see that on the bottle of the grower champagne.
Yeah, and there are something like 3,200 of these growers in Champagne who make what they sell. You know, as opposed to the 16,200 pure growers, these 3,000 plus actually make and sell the wines beyond, you know, selling the grapes.
Well, that's what the Christie's Encyclopedia of Champagne and Sparkling Wine tells us. And it also reveals a profound economic truth about champagne. This is a serious business. It's incredibly hard to get established and make a success of producing and selling champagne. You know, it costs eye-watering amounts to buy the kit to make the wines and then finance your stock holdings because, of course, champagne needs to age for years before it can go to market. Yeah. And then after all that, you still have to sell the stuff in a highly competitive marketplace.
Yeah. So what does that mean for the houses and for the growers?
Yeah, well, the champagne houses are the ones that have traditionally focused on building up the sales and the distribution networks. Mm. So there are 370 houses in the region. Mm. They only own 10% of the region's vineyard, but they account for 72% of Champagne sales.
So only 10% of the vineyard, but they account for, you know, 72%
pretty
of
much
sales.
Three quarters of sales.
So, you know, the houses,
yeah,
by and large, control the majority of Champagne sales.
Exactly, exactly, mm, yeah. So even more so when you talk about exports, you know, the houses account for around 90% of Champagne exports.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So they have tended to be the commercial gatekeepers, as it
yeah
were.
So what about the growers then? Where do they fit into the commercial picture?
Well, you know, as I say, when the balance of sales power is so concentrated in one model, which is a fairly large scale, it can be hard to compete. Moët and Chandon are thought to make upwards of 30 million bottles a year. Mm. Aigle Urier sells 200,000 in a good year. But since the 1980s and 1990s, there has been a shift in the champagne matrix, you might call it. Mm. There's a new breed of ambitious grower champagne producers that has emerged, aiming for top quality, you know, smallish production wines, often organic, focused on the vineyard and terroir.
Yeah, and those things were never really a priority for the houses, were they? Because,
no,
you know, what they did was the big blends, you know, often from all across the region,
yeah,
because they had to, because they were buying from
absolutely
all across the region. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And this phenomenon that we're talking about with the growers happened around the same time that wine drinkers and wine producers were really reacting against homogeneity and standardization in wine, you know. Mm. The natural wine scene was starting to take off, for example. You know, and people were starting to question the accepted norms. You know, like, why do we not talk about the vineyards in Champagne? Why are there so few interesting smaller producers there like there are in Burgundy?
Yeah. So I guess
these sort of questions.
Yeah, which is the right questions and the interesting questions. But I guess you get into a mindset, don't you, about certain regions.
Mm.
And I guess that probably created opportunities for smaller grower producers who were then able to focus on this kind of ethos and this kind of wine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, there are different kinds of grower champagnes, and it's always worth bearing this in mind when you generalise about the various sectors in Champagne or look at the headline figures. You know, some growers make modest, good value wines that sell well in France or at the cellar door.
Mm.
But others, the kind of growers we're interested in here, you know, they're setting very high standards with their intense focus on healthy, quality-oriented vineyards and making serious, characterful wines that are light years away from your bog-standard, mass-produced, non-vintage champagne.
Yeah, yeah. And these are the guys changing the narrative in Champagne,
yeah,
you know, proving that Champagne can be a terroir wine, can be individual, can be characterful, and it can, you know, can be eco-friendly too.
Absolutely, you know, and this comes after, of course, the scandal of the Gadus the 1970s and 1980s when Champagne growers essentially used urban waste to fertilise, and I use that term firmly in inverted commas, to fertilise their vineyard.
Shocking.
You know, with the result that you can even today see hideous coloured plastic poking up through the soil in so many vineyards. I mean, a serious clean-up job was long overdue.
Yeah, but so this new approach, though, it sounds like hard work, you know. Being organic in a relatively cloudy, rainy region like Champagne can't be easy. And, you know, and it therefore also sounds expensive.
Well, these wines aren't cheap. They're not cheap wines, you know. Oh, well, Champagne rarely is. And I'd argue that grower champagnes often represent pretty amazing value compared to the big houses, you know, especially given what you get in the glass tends to be much more rewarding and complex.
Yeah, if you like that kind of thing. But, I guess, you know, you must have to be pretty brave to take this on as a grower. You know, it's a big investment, you know, not so much time, you know, not only on production, but also selling as well. And often these are kind of family enterprises, aren't they? They're family businesses. So there aren't sort of armies of staff to help out.
No, I mean, seriously, I mean, it's a bit of a labour of love, which is why so many growers, you know, opt for an easy life and just sell their grapes and take the cash to the bank. And if you look at the figures, although there's been a lot of chat and hype about grower champagnes over the past few decades, the actual figures for overall volume sales of grower champagnes are down by about a quarter over the past 20 years. I mean, they accounted for about 18% of champagne shipments volumes as of 2022.
Yeah, and I think they were, what, 24% back in 1999. So that is, it's down a quarter.
Down.
But, you know, but surely within that, there are growers doing well.
Evidently so. You know, those figures are volume sales, remember, not value. But when you talk to these producers, you do get a real sense they're working for the survival of Champagne as a serious wine region, that these are solid, profitable businesses, and they feel there is a bright future ahead.
Yeah, and that's important at a time when Champagne sales seem to be fluctuating quite wildly, don't they? There was a huge drop in 2020, wasn't there, because of COVID lockdowns?
Yeah. Yeah.
Then sales boomed in 2021 and 2022.
Yeah.
And then the most recent figures for 2023 that have just come through show a big drop, you know, back in volume, more in line with what was happening in 2019, so pre-COVID, but a real roller coaster.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not easy in Champagne at the moment.
No.
You know, there have been a few challenging vintages. Climate change is having an impact. The cost of living crisis is also a major headwind. You know, maybe people overstocked in 2021 and 22. And however you look at it, Champagne isn't cheap, as we've said. You know, average prices are actually going up as well. So inflationary is a trend. And there's more and more competition.
So I guess all the more reason to focus on quality over quantity.
I think
And carving out a niche where people buy your brand, not just because of price or vague brand recognition, but actually because, you know, it tastes unique and people believe in what you're doing.
Yeah. Amen to that, yeah. So at this point, I'd like to bring in Charles Lee. He's the owner and director of Lee and Sandeman Wine Merchants, who have 5 shops in southwest London and also a pretty nifty website where you can buy their wines too. Lee and Sandeman are well regarded in wine circles, mainly because right from the start they've been real treasure hunters, you know, heading out into winelands all over the world to find the gems in the rough, unique wines with something to say for themselves, grower champagnes included.
And this story has a COVID-related twist, which needs a bit of a preface, because during lockdown, when champagne sales dropped off a cliff, as I said, the champagne producers decided to limit the 2020 harvest for fear of oversupply. So artificially creating a small harvest, if you like. Then the 2021 vintage was really quite challenging, so small again. But this coincided with a boom in sales in 2021, as I've said already. So you had short supply, but surging demand. This, you know, as well as disruption in the supplies of raw materials, including bottles, meant that lots of the big houses put sales on allocation, which, you know, so restricted their sales, what people could buy in the markets, which was unheard of.
Yeah, unheard of. And it didn't go down too well with some people, I think, Charles Lee included. So Charles decided in late 2021 to take himself off round Champagne to find alternative supplies. And in doing so, found so many brilliant smaller growers that he snapped up loads of them and revamped his entire Champagne portfolio in the process.
Now we're going to hear a little bit about this in the interview, but first off, I asked Charles how, in his view, Champagne has evolved of late.
Oh no, I think there has been a real qualitative jump, which has come from, yeah, maybe global warming even, but there is a sense in which people are getting grapes ripe now, like Aigle. You know, and when we took on Gonet Medeville, who was one we took on some time ago, he said, I want to make champagnes like I've tasted from the 50s, 60s, because I want to make champagnes that can last. And I love the taste of old champagne and the way that it develops and the way that it ages. And that's what really interests me. And if I couldn't do that, I wouldn't bother. Because he was, you know, he had the choice. He could have not done what he's done. And so could Aigle, and so could quite a number of the others. But we're seeing nowadays in the world of fine wine, in other areas, I think you see it in America, with some of the productions of the big companies who have fancy labels, where you taste the wine, which has been blended to be perfect, and as a result, it's so boring that you want to scream. And what interests me is to try different things the whole time. And we do it with everywhere else. I mean, in Burgundy, I've got growers who make every style, and it annoys me when people say, oh, they're making such old-fashioned wine. Well, old-fashioned they may be. Try them when they're 30 years old and then tell me that you don't think they're great, is my answer to those people. And I think the same is true in champagne. I'm sure you can have very lovely, elegant champagnes which will taste good today and will be history and ashes in 5 years. And you can have things from Aigle Urier, which if you don't put it away for 3 or 4 years, you're probably not getting your money's worth. That would be my way of looking at it.
In terms of the wines in the glass, if you were going to sum up, I'm a customer who's just walked through the door of your shop, why should I buy Grower champagnes? What makes them different in the glass? What am I going to taste that's different about these wines?
I think you'll taste individuality. You taste an expression of a wine as opposed to the art of blending. Sometimes they're a result of what they do in the vineyard and the art of blending. Obviously, there's a lot of blending goes on in a lot of the non-vintage cuvées that we deal with. But I love the idea that you can taste the difference between a wine that comes from Le Ménil and a wine that comes from Cremant. They're both pure Chardonnay, they're both Grand Cru. Why? Because of where they come from. Just like in Burgundy, you can taste the difference between a Chambord and a Pommard, you'd hope. They're perhaps more different than two champagnes from the Côte de Blanc. But there is definitely a difference. And I find that completely fascinating. And I think a lot of people who are in the wine world do. And that's why the top end, the very top end of the wine market is, I think, more susceptible to being interested in this sort of champagne than others.
And are these wines accessible? Because, you know, from what you're saying, it sounds like grower champagne is more individuality, more character. That can be scary to some people. You know, are these wines, can they be accessible as well? Are they fun?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, that's the whole point, is they're fun. They're completely delicious. You put them in your mouth and you want to swallow them. And that's what, to me, there's a transparency about them, which just makes them completely delicious. No, I think they're absolutely delicious. And I think the fact that they are means that people come back and buy them again and again, which they do. But they're also, having tried one, they go, oh, well, that was good. Is that one good too? And you go, yes. And so to me, there is a real advantage in having lots of different ones, just like there is in having lots of different Burgundies. I think people in the past have got a bit brand fixated. You know, I'm a Bollinger man. I'm a Krugiest, or I'm a... No, it's not necessary. You don't have to stick with one. I would encourage you to try all of them. But then I would encourage you to try all wine, because I think all wine is fascinating and drinking the same one over and over again is boring. I went over to Champagne with the specific idea of trying to find some more supply to get us through Christmas. And I realised just how many fantastic more growers there were than we already had. And I started to sign up more of them and got very, very enthusiastic about it. Possibly slightly too enthusiastic. But as I say, there is a sort of snowball effect whereby people who have tried one of these wines are much more prepared to try another and then go, well, actually, maybe I don't need to always go back to the brand which I used to identify with.
And even you, as someone who had been importing and selling grower champagne for a while, you still got slightly over-enthusiastic about what you saw out there in Champagne during lockdown in terms of grower champagnes.
Yeah, I think I did. I mean, you know, the more I tasted, the more I went around, the more I went, well, what are we doing with promoting, LVMH's big brands when we can have all of these and they're individual to us? Yes, it'll take a bit more work. But, you know, we say we're the on the side of the people who are interested in fine wine. This is where it is. So we've got to promote these.
Charles, thank you very much indeed.
Not at all.
LVMH, by the way, being the multinational owner of Moët & Chandon, Krug, Veuve Clicquot and others. But here we're talking about champagne moving towards terroir wines full of character and which clearly got Charles Lee pretty enthused, possibly a little too enthused in his own words.
But, you know, you can understand it from a wine lover's point of view, can't you? You know, these are wines that invite a sense of sort of intellectual
curiosity, as well as sheer enjoyment and hedonism. And you can argue that's something champagne's been lacking before they came on the scene.
Totally, yeah, yeah. So that's what we're going to come on to very shortly. How and why great grower champagne stimulates what Hercule Poirot might term the little grey cells. And we're going to do that by chatting with Francis and Clémence Aigli of Champagne Aigli Urier, and then tasting an epic range of grower champagnes. To recap so far, grower champagnes are a small but important part of this famous region's output, with the best producers earning iconic status for their relentless focus on their vineyards and on terroir expression in the wines. Charles Lee was so impressed that he revamped his champagne portfolio during lockdown, and he hasn't looked back since.
Now, one prominent grower who Charles mentioned a few times is Aigli Urier. Along with the likes of Celos and L'Amandier Bernier, this is one of the grower champagnes with a cult following. They're based on the Montagne d'Arras and are renowned for their incredibly powerful, intense wines, which are also refined and precise, the product of immense attention to detail and impeccable farming.
Francis Aigli is a fourth generation grower, but it was only after he started working for the family business that Aigli Urier began to bottle and sell its own wines in the 90s. His dad Michel, though, famously actually refused to take the urban waste on his vineyards in the 1970s. Anyway, Francis is a man with a reputation for being a perfectionist. One of his key tenets is harvesting ripe, often starting after others have finished. Then long lees aging to give complexity, but also to allow the terroir to shine through in the wines. Oak is used for the Grand Crus, but mainly to oxygenate the wines and to allow small batch winemaking. Low dosage is the norm, so we're talking dry styles.
Aigli Urier makes proper wine. You know, serious wines, which are so popular they can be hard to get hold of. So I was very privileged to get to sit down with Francis and his daughter Clémence, who not only makes the wines with Francis, but also was acting on this occasion as her father's translator. Something that would strain any father-daughter relationship, I think it's fair to say. We tasted, as we chatted, in a London restaurant with very creaky floorboards about grower champagne in general and what they do in particular. I started with a deceptively simple question. What is grower champagne?
Whoa.
Simple question, but not simple necessarily easy.
Simple. Grower champagne is someone that do a lot of things at the same time, I would say. It's someone that work a lot in the vineyard first, because it's the main difference. Grower champagne owns his vineyards. He knows exactly his terroir, the soil, and he knows what to do at what time for the harvest. And yes, so it's someone that is at the same time in the vineyards, in the cellar after, to take care of the vinification, then to take care of the bottles, of the preparation of the bottles, preparation of the order, and someone also who takes the order and deal with all the clients. So it's someone that has a lot of different facets.
So it sounds like a lot of work.
Yes, it is, I would say.
Selling your own wines as well as growing the grapes is a lot of work. So becoming a grower, not just selling your grapes to the big houses, that's a big commitment. So my question would be, what's the motivation to do that?
Oh, it's to make something from the beginning to the end and to see the result of your work, I would say. So it's nice when you are engaged in your vineyards to be able then to make wines with the grapes that you produce. If you sell the grapes, your work stop just in the middle of the process. So I think it's better to do everything.
So a sense of satisfaction of seeing your work from beginning to end.
Yeah. And it's the same with the commercialization. If you make the wines but you don't see people drinking it, it's also not normal.
Yes, yeah. How do you see the grower champagne phenomenon more broadly? How have things changed over the years, and what situation are we in now in terms of grower champagnes?
Oh, there are more and more people engaged in the vineyards and making his own champagne. Even the young generation, we started to make again wines, and their parents were not only selling grapes to the big houses, so they start again the production of champagne. So I think there is a big movement in Champagne with the younger generation, and it's good because it's good for us, it's good for the image of the grower Champagne.
It's good for the Champagne.
It's good for Champagne, and we are like kind of stronger together because, for example, our own production is very small compared to the whole production of Champagne. And if you have other growers that give a good image of grower Champagne, you all work in the same way and it's good for everyone.
Now, you talk about the connection with the vineyard. You're very well known for harvesting your grapes ripe, in a region where this is not necessarily usual or common. Why do you do that? How easy is it to do that?
Moi, je peux répondre en français, mais c'était ma vision de faire du vin. Toutes les rencontres que j'ai pu faire, c'était quand même plutôt en vendangeant des raisins mûrs qu'on faisait des...
So, the vision of my father was to reach a high level of ripeness in the grapes at the harvest, because he learned it from his different meetings with other producers. From Burgundy, for example, when he went there to meet some producer and to try to learn and try to understand the way they produce their wine. So it was an inspiration from them, from the Burgundy wines, and it was his vision to get a good level of brightness.
But in Champagne, the accepted truth is sometimes that, oh, it's Champagne, it needs to be a little bit acidic and not properly ripe to make a basis for a great wine. But that's not what you do.
We harvest ripe, but our wines don't miss acidity. You still have a high level of acidity. The only difference is that the dosage is lower and that you have a better complexity in the wines because you have more aromas due to the ripeness of the grapes.
I've never a problem of acidity in Champagne. It's not a problem of acidity. It's always enough.
And that harvesting ripe, what does that give you? Is it complexity?
Yes, a complexity with ripe grapes.
Complexity, more aromas, more flavors in the wines. It's more natural flavors.
And you can have a lower dosage at the end of it as well.
Yes. Dosage
is always with a good harvest, and when the harvest is good, the grape is ripe.
Now, one of your stated aims is for your wines to reflect your terroir as well. How do you achieve that?
By the ripeness of the grapes, of course. So we try to respect as much as we can the terroir. So for that, we go almost every day in the vineyard to work the vines. And then, as we said, it's very important to harvest very ripe. Of course, you need to wait a longer time, so you take more risk. Sometimes you never know what can happen. But at the end, it is with ripe grapes that you have the best flavors in the bottles and the more complexity. So after, also for... to highlight the terroir, we also barrels. We work with barrels for most of the production. So all the Grand Cru cuvées are vinified in barrels. So it's parcel by parcels. So everything is vinified separately.
And Francis, you've also said something about, you know, terroir and Champagne is much more than about just yeasty flavors, levure, or, you know, the flavors that derive from the lees and the yeast. And that those characters only come out in the bottle after you give it time in the bottle. And I was interested in asking you more about that. Why is that?
Pour que ce goût de levure disparaisse, il faut au minimum 3 ans. Au profit du terroir, parce que là, c'est à ce moment-là que le terroir peut commencer à s'exprimer, puisque...
So, at the beginning, after the fermentation, the wine has more yeasty flavor, and it's only after 3 or 4 years of aging that this yeasty flavor disappears, And after you have more the flavor of the terroir that take place in the bottles. So at the beginning, it will more be the yeasty flavors, and after 3 or 4 years, it will more be about fruits, flowers, and after you have also the tertiary aromas, but it's very personal.
But for you, it's a minimum of 3 years before those kind of characters can start to come out in the bottle.
Yes.
And it loses,
yes, for me, the minimum, yes.
Loses the yeasty.
Before it's fermentation.
It's fermentation.
Really, fermentation, so. Yes. It's good also, but it's fermentation.
But it's different. And champagne different. Can be more than just fermentation flavors.
You can like a champagne with 1 year or 2 years of bottles, but this is the taste of this good ale.
And Francis, you said one of the biggest mistakes in champagne is to go against nature. What did you mean by that?
Il faut jamais aller contre un millésime. On est là pour exprimer une année, un terroir, une particularité. On n'est pas là pour faire quelque chose de forcément de régulier. Régulier dans la qualité, mais pas régulier dans le goût.
So, not going against nature, it's obvious. Because of course, when you walk outside with the vineyards, you cannot go against nature. But what is more important is not going against the vintage. For example, when it's a hot vintage, there is no sense to harvest earlier to get more acidity in the wines. You need to make wines that reflect the vintage, and highlight the year.
So to make sort of singular wines which have a unique identity, which have a consistency of quality, but not a consistency of character all the time.
Not all the time. In the vintage, no. In the wines that are blends, it's different. We try to compensate by adding reserve wine to the wine of the year to have something more consistent. But for the vintage, if you make a vintage 2018, you need to have something like ripe and...
So just thinking about this then, this consistency or character, if you could summarize Aigle Ourrier's style, character, in 3 words, what would it be?
Ripeness, aging.
La base, c'est la vigne.
Vineyard.
la base, ça reste le travail à la vigne. Donc, c'est essayer de produire les raisins les plus beaux possibles, les raisins les plus sains possibles. Et c'est quand même à la vigne que le vin se fait. Donc c'est vraiment la base de la philosophie de la maison.
C'est plus que 3 mots.
3 mots, on va dire. La vigne.
Oui.
2, la vigne. 3, la vigne.
OK. What does the future hold for you, Aigle Ourrier, but also for grower champagne in general?
I hope it's a bright future. I don't know. I think that if everyone is working in the good way, respecting the vines, trying to make a good wine, it will be good.
Le futur, il s'inscrit aujourd'hui, c'est-à-dire si les vins sont très bons, tout est fait. Donc le futur, c'est ça, c'est tous ceux qui travailleront bien dans le futur, et ben ils seront récompensés, j'espère pour eux, de leurs efforts.
So people are more and more looking for high quality product and authenticity in the product that they buy, for craftsmanship. So I think the future of grower champagne can be a good future if people try to make quality product and put a lot of effort in their winemaking process and the way they conduct their vineyards.
Francis, Clémence, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I loved his solution to the 3-word summary challenge. You know, speaks volumes, doesn't it? The vines, the vines, the vines.
Yeah.
But I wanted to pick up on one thing. You know, his point that the wines need at least 3 to 4 years of lees aging before the terroir can start to shine through.
Yeah, I found that really interesting too.
I had no idea about that.
It's interesting, isn't it? You know, so he says it takes that time for the wines to shrug off their fermentive or lees dominated aromas of yeastiness to start to show their terroir and nuance and subtlety, which is why his wines are long lees aged. You know, so it's not just about the intense focus on the vineyard and harvesting ripe and using oak barrels. It's also about judging your maturation process, getting it right so that you can emerge the other end with a wine that's not only rich and complex, but also very individual and very detailed and not at all standardised. I think that's the point.
I think he said that about other champagnes, that we've been conditioned to think that these characters of yeast and fermentation are the real characters of champagne, you know, those sort of bready, biscuity flavours. Mm. When they're not, you know, and he's trying to show that isn't true.
Mm. And he was clear that this isn't easy, you know, doing what he's doing. C'est pas la facilité, I think he said at one point. It's not the easy path, but in his mind, it's the right path and it's the best path. And, you know, you have to say his wines do back him up. You know, Francis says champagne before anything is a wine and the bubbles are kind of a bonus.
Well, you can say that because you got to enjoy a rather nice tasting with Francis and Clémence, didn't you?
Yeah, I confess I did.
You did?
Yes. and in the process, I believe I became the first person in the UK to try a brand new cuvée of theirs. At least it's new to the UK. I think the first release went to France and to the US in tiny quantities. It's called Les Vignes de Bisseuil. Just thinking about, you know, being the first to try it in the UK, does that make me like a wine superhero?
Oh, I'm sure it does. Yeah. Marvel. You are marvellous.
I think I'm just lucky, aren't I? The right mouse in the right place at the right time. Story of my life. Anyway, you know, we have both tasted their wines over the years, haven't we?
Yeah,
and we've always been interested. And we've got one of them here in front of us too. This was an intriguing tasting with them both.
And any highlights?
Yeah, so Les Vignes de Vrigny Premier Cru, which is pure Pinot Meunier, was full of clotted cream and red apple, really juicy and lifted, made in stainless steel, not oak, to preserve the freshness in that wine, 3 years on the lees, which according to Francis is the minimum you need for sort of finesse of bubbles. And the Grand Cru Ambonnet, non-vintage with the 2023 release, was really powerful and rich, but also, you know, really fresh and revitalizing, you know, immensely serious wine.
And then this super duper new cuvée that you mentioned.
Oh yeah, sorry. Les Vignes de Bisseuil, Premier Cru. It's unusually for them, it's a Chardonnay dominant cuvée. Mainly they're all about the Pinot Noir, but this one's Chardonnay mainly from a new vineyard they bought 10 years ago, but they've been restoring. It's vinified in oak. And Francis says, you know, we had a lot of fun making this. We're known for Pinot Noir, but this is something different. And then he flashed that very impish smile that he has. he's a wonderful guy. But the wine is gorgeous. It is apple pie, baked cream, yeasty, but delicate, layered, wonderful juicy acidity, very vinous. It's a word I'd use about a lot of their wines. They're serious wines. Yeah. I just wrote stunning.
Okay. So one to keep an eye out for.
Sorry you missed out on that one.
I did, didn't I? Yeah, I bet you are. Yes.
Together soon.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. Anyway, yeah, let's keep an eye out for that. By the way, we will put all details of the wines and prices on our website. All of these are, of course, available from Lee & Sandemann, although I don't think the Bisseuil has been released yet.
No, no. I think they told me it was coming to the UK in late 2024. And they didn't have a price yet. So we move on to other things that are here.
Yes, good call. So we tasted through a bunch of grower champagnes from Lee & Sandemann, and it was without doubt one of the best small tastings we've done in quite some time. Just amazing character and complexity in the wines.
Yeah.
These are not quaffing wines.
No,
you need to sit with them, think about them, interact with them.
Yeah.
Don't you say?
You're
doing that now, aren't you?
I've lost you to interact. just pouring a little bit, just a little bit extra. as you say, they're serious, proper wines. You know, these are not crowd pleasing champagnes. It's a different kind of champagne. Anyway, first up, we've got the Christophe Mignon ADN de Meunier Brut Nature. So this is pure Pinot Meunier from the Marne Valley. Quite deeply coloured, isn't it, in the glass?
Yeah, it is.
Lovely, yeasty, mealy, rich red apple and dried flower aromas. And then on the palate, it's really long and very dry, but also quite saline and great with food. And this from an estate that works with biodynamic, homeopathic and geobiological farming. They harvest ripe, they're low intervention and mostly focus on Meunier. Just really lovely wines.
Mm. Now, I've got the Nicolas Maillard Platine Premier Cru Extra Brut, which is about £40, so a little bit less than the Mignon. Now, this estate is based in the Montagne de Reims, like Aigle-Urier, and works mainly with Pinot Noir and with barrel vinification. And this wine is all about hedonistic richness. You know, you've got, again, this deep sort of antique gold colour and then bready, peachy, biscuity aromas. You know, it's mouth-coating, it's self-assured, it's kind of like a gnarly old boy sinking back into a leather chair in the pub, at ease with the world. It's just fabulous and so much wine for the price.
Yeah, I love that, love that. So I've got the Aigle-Urier Le Prémisse Extra Brut Envy. It's a 2022 release, so based on the 2019 vintage. This is a cuvée they introduced relatively recently, actually, almost as a sort of easygoing introduction to their, what you might term their house style. It's got a very classic champagne character, hasn't it? Really classic. Yeah. One of the most classic here. But, you know, in a very expressive and really engaging style. It's full of fresh bread, roasted red apple, super fine bubbles. Really complex on the palate, isn't it? It's seamless and cogent. It's proper wine. Amazing energy and precision, like all of their wines.
Yum. Now, La Mondier Bernier is another celebrated grower based in the Côte des Blancs, so more Chardonnay focused, fully certified organic and biodynamic, with the wines known for being pure and precise. Now, this is their Latitude Extra Brut Blanc de Blanc Premier Cru NV, non-vintage, and it's so fragrant and fine, you know, classic Chardonnay in its lemony green apple aromas and tangy acidity. You've also got some oyster shell and flinty notes, and then overlaid with bready complexity and hints of acacia honey. You know, lots of pure fruit here, a slightly ethereal quality to it, sort of filigree and beautiful, just beautiful,
almost sort of dainty, you could say. And then finally, Champagne Roger Coulon farms organically across the Côte des Blancs and Montagne de Reims. He uses agroforestry, ripe fruits, oak vinification, low dosage. Are we spotting a trend here?
We are indeed. And
the wine, the Roger Coulon wine, the millésime 2013 Blanc de Noir Premier Cru, is just sensational. Isn't it?
It really, really is.
It's a blend of equal parts Meunier and Pinot Noir. It smells like toasted bread and truffles and red apples. And it's elegant and enjoyable. It just unfurls across your palate. It's just gorgeous.
I'd agree. Mm. I don't normally, but I would in this particular instance. It's not cheap. That one's the most expensive one we tried at about £112 a bottle. But I'd argue it's still definitely value for money. You know, it's a very special wine.
Yeah.
A good moment, a high note to wrap things up on.
Yeah, well said. Going out with a bang, as ever. One thing I would say is that there are so many good growers out there. It's so much fun experimenting and trying new things and supporting this really exciting brigade of brave independent producers. You know, the wines will not leave you disappointed. You know, in fact, the inspiration for this episode was a tasting of a whole load of Leon Sandemann's growers, and it was just sensational. It was mind-blowing. It was brilliant. It featured the producers here and then also ones like Le Gras, Frank Bonneville, Lancelot Pien, Barnaud, Marc Ebrard, Gonet Medville, Margate. You know, it's a whole new world of champagne, and it's well worth exploring.
So there we have it. No more screaming from boredom of big production wines, as Charles Lee might say. Grower Champagne is here to spice up your sparkling life.
There we go.
By way of closing summary, Top Grower Champagne emerged as a pioneering force in the 1990s and 2000s and is now widely celebrated for the emphasis it places on the vineyard and terroir expression in the wines. Wines which tend to be characterful, complex and thought-provoking. While not cheap, these wines are revitalising the region and giving wine lovers a new kind of champagne with which to tantalise not only our taste buds, but our little grey cells too.
Cheers to that. Thanks to our guests, Charles Lee, and both Francis and Clémence Aigley. We're very grateful to Lee and Sanderman for sponsoring this episode. Thanks also to you for listening. Until next time, cheers.